Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Rumsfeld appeared today before the Senate Armed Services Committee and was asked, will he reduce troop numbers in Iraq? We'll hear how he responded in a moment, but first, a touchdown in the Middle East. Israel is reporting that 7 people were killed in northern Israel today by Hezbollah rockets. That's the worst daily toll in Israel in 3 weeks of fighting. Meanwhile, in Beirut, a group of relief agencies held a press conference today to ask for a ceasefire, or at least a safe passage, for relief workers and refugees caught in the crossfire between Israel and Hezbollah militants. By some estimates, over 800,000 Lebanese civilians, nearly a quarter of that country's population, have been displaced from their homes, a number so large that it's overwhelming the towns where they seek shelter. Joining us from Beirut is Cassandra Nelson, Senior Communications Officer of Mercy Corps. And Cassandra, World Vision, Oxfam, Christian Aid, Save the Children, and Islamic Relief Worldwide are all calling for this ceasefire. Mercy Corps as well?
Definitely. No, I think that all humanitarian aid organizations working here are very unified on this point. It is really part of standard humanitarian international law, and it's part of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and it's something that has not been met and that we are all very actively demanding is met quickly.
Well, Israeli, a former ministry spokesman, has said that Israel is doing its best to allow aid convoys to move into Lebanon. Since Tuesday, they say they've allowed deliveries by more than 40 convoys. What do you think the problems are?
Well, the problems have been manyfold. There was a announcement there would be a cessation in airstrikes. That came across at about 1 a.m. Monday morning, Beirut time, and that agreement quickly fell apart. By mid-morning here, there were citing reports of shelling, of airstrikes in certain areas, and it just continued on. Certainly in the areas that we were working, they received airstrikes on Monday and on Tuesdays, and it certainly jeopardizes the lives of the humanitarian aid workers here, as well as certainly the innocent civilians who are caught behind those battle lines.
A spokesperson for the UN World Food Program said that one of the problems that he sees is that Israeli officials haven't agreed to safe delivery corridors. Instead, they're insisting that each individual convoy get permission to travel. Is that one of the problems, that there's no one corridor that you know you can travel on?
Definitely. I mean, at this point, the way that some organizations have been working is to seek permission or a guarantee of safe access from the Israeli authorities. And in that case, it is a case-by-case basis. It's every individual aid organization, doesn't matter if you're taking down one truckload or 20 truckloads, it has to go through the process every day. Mm-hmm. And they then can either, you know, give you permission or not. Now, Mercy Corps, we actually chose not to go that direction. We did not seek permission from the Israeli government to deliver aid to Lebanese people. We decided to make our own decision based on our security analysis and then to notify the Israeli authorities that we were doing this. So we notified them of our plans, of our intended route, and what our activities would be. And then we moved forward, again, based on a lot of information we've gathered from people on the ground in the communities we were working in. We took a Lebanese police escort down with us. So the whole way down, we had a legal government official taking us down and taking us back out.
We understand, in fact, that Mercy Corps was the first to have an organized relief convoy to reach a devastated part of southern Lebanon, about 3,000 people there that got their first food supplies. What did Mercy Corps see there?
I went down with the convoy, and when we came into it, it was an area called Marjayoun, and it's in the southeast Lebanon, close to the border with Israel. I was quite surprised that the community is a very mixed community. You see mosques, you see churches, and it turns out there's a very large Orthodox population that lives there. So it was a very mixed. It wasn't what I expected, which it was something to be, you know, perhaps much more of a Shia area because it has undergone a lot of bombing. And I was surprised to see an area that has such a large Christian population to have, you know, fallen under so much bombardment.
What was the biggest need?
The biggest need was definitely food items and blankets, but food items primarily. They've really been cut off for 3 weeks. They have really not received any regular consistent kinds of supplies. The only way they've been getting supplies in is that if somebody basically drives in, there's been these taxi cabs that have been kind of making the run between Beirut and the villages, trying to ferry out people who want to escape from the bombing. Sometimes they'll put things in their trunk and drive down and sell those things on the local market. But again, they're very expensive. Most families can't afford to buy these items, and there's not much of it.
That's the scene in southern Lebanon. But back to the refugee situation in some of the bigger cities as these southern refugees come north, we hear that some agencies are thinking of setting up tent cities. How big a crisis is this getting to be?
Well, this is a massive crisis. I mean, this is almost a million people displaced. In the period of 3 weeks, there isn't space, time, or resources to absorb nearly 1 million people who are coming out of the south and looking for some kind of safety and security. It's a huge humanitarian crisis. It is going to take logistics, it's going to take fuel, something that we're lacking tremendously here. It's going to take money to get the food items in, and it's going to take personnel coming in to really drive this humanitarian aid effort. The humanitarian corridors just into the city, into the country, I'm not talking into the south, but just so we can actually bring aid workers into Beirut, have finally just started to open up. But we have been waiting for staff that's been trying to get in for about the last week. The challenges that we're facing are immense.
Cassandra Nelson, speaking to us from Beirut. She's been there 2 weeks now with Mercy Corps providing humanitarian assistance. Cassandra, thank you.
Thank you.
And now to the war in Iraq. Yesterday, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld suggested he was too busy to attend a Senate hearing on Iraq. Today, after Democrats loudly complained, he showed up, along with two of the Pentagon's top generals, who both told Congress that the recent surge in sectarian violence in Baghdad means Iraq could be sliding into civil war. Senator John McCain, a Republican, pressed them on that subject.
General Pace, you said there's a possibility of the situation in Iraq evolving into civil war. Is that correct?
I did say that, yes, sir.
Did you anticipate this situation a year ago?
No, sir.
Did you, General Abizaid?
I believe that a year ago it was clear to see that sectarian tensions were increasing. That they would be this high? No.
Well, we want to take some time today to listen in on these hearings, and to do that, we're joined from Washington by Bob Deans, national correspondent for Cox Newspapers. Bob, you had General Pace and General Abizaid there, two of the leaders in the region. You've been watching the hearing. Was that a dramatic admission from those generals?
I think it was, Rob, and I think that what it said was that where they had hoped to be a year ago, they are not, and they certainly in a number of ways stepped back. You know, Robin, when the Secretary of Defense and his top generals go up to the Senate before the Armed Services Committee, you can believe that they are doing everything they can to cast the situation in the most possible, brightest light possible. And even so, what they took up there was a very grim story. After 2,600 Americans killed and 20,000 wounded, we're told now that casualties could well increase in the weeks ahead. After $436 billion spent, we heard generals talking about we don't have enough money to repair armored vehicles as quickly as they're getting worn out and blown up in Iraq. And that after training 275,000 Iraqis, that country is nowhere near ready to secure its own country. And then you hear the walking back, as you talked about, talk now that the country could indeed be sliding towards civil war, coming from the top generals out of the Pentagon, walking back that expectation that had been raised last year by General Casey that we would be dramatically, significantly was his word, reducing U.S. troop levels in Iraq this year. We were told today, don't expect that to be happening. And in the big picture here, again and again, the theme returned to by Generals Abizaid, General Pace, and by Secretary Rumsfeld was this is part of a bigger picture. This is part of what the Pentagon calls the long war against Islamic radicalism, and part of what they are seeing as a generational Cold War-type struggle.
Well, we want to hear from Secretary Rumsfeld in a moment, but let's listen to a little more of the exchanges between senators and generals. Again, between Senator McCain, this time General Abizaid, the top U.S. commander in the Middle East. And this is an exchange on moving troops from one hot spot to another.
What I worry about is we're playing a game of whack-a-mole here. Everybody knows we've got big problems in Ramadi. And I said, where are you going to get the troops? Well, we're going to have to move them from Fallujah. Now we're going to have to move troops into Baghdad from someplace else. It's very disturbing. And if it's all up to the Iraqi military, General Abizaid, and if it's all up to them, then I wonder why we have to move troops into Baghdad to intervene in what is clearly sectarian violence.
Senator, also Iraqi troops are being moved into Baghdad. The number of Iraqi troops in the Baghdad area are greater than our troops. We are in support with them in the main operational areas, and I believe that under the current circumstances that the Iraqi forces need to benefit from our command and control capabilities.
Bob Deans, what do you make of that exchange? The news broke just last week about moving troops from the north back to Baghdad.
There's a whole lot of weight attached to that exchange, Robin. From the very beginning, there were people who were saying there aren't enough American troops going in Iraq to secure the weapons caches, to keep insurgents from getting those weapons, to secure the country. Senator McCain was one of those people who from the start said, we're going in too light, we don't have enough people to do the job. And so he returned to that theme today with the whack-a-mole situation where we're having to pull people out of areas that lives were lost to secure, and we're now having to leave those areas when they're not known to be secure to put troops into Baghdad. Hillary Clinton also visited that theme as part of the litany that she outlined in her comments when she told Secretary Rumsfeld that he was presiding over a failed policy.
In fact, we have that. Senator Hillary Clinton of New York did spar with Secretary Rumsfeld. Let's listen to that exchange.
There's a track record here. This is not 2002, 2003, 2004, 5, when you appeared before this committee and made many comments and presented, you know, many assurances that have frankly proven to be unfulfilled.
And Senator, I don't think that's true. I have never painted a rosy picture. I've been very measured in my words, and you have a Dickens of a time trying to find instances where I've been excessively optimistic. I understand this is tough stuff.
Bob Deans, after that, those words from Rumsfeld, I believe I remember that Senator Clinton called for some of his passwords to be put on the record.
Absolutely, she did, and there is a track record. There is a four-year history of this. This is the administration that told us we have a clear military plan. We will attain our objective. We know what we're doing, and those words will come back to haunt many administration officials. And you heard the secretary saying this is tough stuff. I think tough and getting tougher is the sub-theme here. Now, there is also a political theme here, which Secretary Rumsfeld alluded to yesterday at the point at which he was saying he wasn't planning to go up to the Hill. And interestingly, Hillary Clinton is running for re-election in her state, New York. She got 55% of the vote last time around, so this is a big issue for her. But perhaps more importantly, she has her eye on a possible presidential run in 08, as does Senator McCain.
And she was one of those who complained, in fact, wrote a letter about the possibility of Rumsfeld not testifying. As we see, he has reacted to that protest on her part and others, and he is there today. We're going to hear more of the testimony before the Senate hearing today. And we're talking to Bob Deans, national correspondent for Cox Newspapers. Much more, many more exchanges. We'll get you to listen to as much as we can when we come back. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Armed Services Committee hearing about the war in Iraq, attended by high-ranking generals and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. We're talking to Bob Deans, national correspondent of Cox Newspapers. He was watching the hearings for us. And now, Bob, let's talk about troop readiness. We heard this week the head of the National Guard saying that only two-thirds of his combat units are ready for action. Senator Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island, challenged Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld on just that topic, how the Iraq war is stretching the resources of the American military, and Rumsfeld challenged that assumption. Let's listen.
Mr. Secretary, it's very clear that two-thirds of the Army Operating Force active reserve is now reporting as unready. There is not a single non-deployed Army Brigade combat team in the United States that is ready to deploy. The bottom line is that we have no ready strategic reserve. And this is a stunning indictment of your leadership.
I think it's an inaccurate statement.
How so? Have you seen the readiness reports, Mr. Secretary?
I have.
And it's inaccurate to say that the readiness reports of the Army does not indicate severe equipment shortages, leading many brigades in the United States as non-deployable?
If you'll allow me a few minutes to respond, it's complicated, but I'd be happy to do so. I stand with what I say. I think the characterization that you made is not accurate.
Well, Bob Deans, can you consolidate Rumsfeld's points? What did he say in response to that?
What he basically said was that the Pentagon has raised the standards for readiness, and that as it has done so, the Army is better trained, better equipped than it was 4 years ago, but because the standards are higher, it is not up to those standards yet. So he is arguing that, yes, the war is grinding on, but that the Pentagon has responded by spending more money on equipment, training, and readiness, and that it's not as bad as it looks. The problem there, though, of course, is that you have outside experts, generals, people who think like these Pentagon folks, who were saying a year ago, if this war continues at its pace, we're really stretching our forces thin at a time when regional challenges are growing. Iran is making trouble in Iraq. Iran is helping to fund Hezbollah. We have the Lebanon situation. It's all tied together, but it's all complicated. It's all poses a potential military challenge at a time when we have interest elsewhere, North Korea, other parts of the world.
Well, speaking of other parts of the world, Secretary Rumsfeld said at one point, what we're seeing in the Middle East is the face of the 21st century, which is wars between systems. What did he mean by that? And, you know, what did the generals or the secretary say about violence that's flaring up across the Middle East?
This is part goes back to what the Pentagon calls the long war against terrorism is the shorthand. What they're really talking about is a strain of Islamic radicalism. 1.4 billion Muslims around the world, a very, very small minority of whom are radicalized and are using violence and are, as the secretary said today, very well connected globally. They're well funded. They have an ideology. They have a long-term strategy. They're very tough to combat in the way that our system is structured. We set up a system that was meant to fight armies with leaders and states, and we're fighting an outfit now that has none of those.
As we mentioned earlier, if you've just tuned in, we're talking to Bob Deans, national correspondent for Cox Newspapers, reacting to today's testimony before the Senate committee looking at Iraq. Secretary Rumsfeld and two generals spoke. And what did the generals, first of all, say about the capability of the Iraqi forces? We heard earlier that they both feared that sectarian violence would lead to civil war, but what about Iraqi military?
This is one of the most troubling pieces of it, Robin, is that for some time now, the president has been saying, as the Iraqi forces stand up, our forces will stand down. Sounded like a good idea 3 years ago, but here we are, 275,000 Iraqi forces trained and not in any way capable of dealing without the United States with this security problem. And I think it was Senator Dayton from Minneapolis who raised this issue. He said, you know, it's not Americans' will that's being tested. It's Americans' patience for failure. What Americans don't understand, and Americans remember 8 weeks, 10 weeks of training for young men who got sent off to World War II, off to Korea, off to Vietnam. We were training helicopter pilots in 12 months to go to Vietnam, kids out of high school. And what a lot of Americans are having a hard time understanding is why, after 3 years, are the Iraqi forces not up, trained, and equipped and prepared to deal with their own security picture?
Well, Massachusetts Senator Ed Kennedy pushed General John Abizaid on when the U.S. could pull out of Iraq. Let's listen.
We've been in Iraq for 40 months and 13 days, the Korean War, 37 months, World War I, 19 months, Persian Gulf War, 3 months, World War II, 42 months, VE Day, 42 months for VED, 45 months for VJ Day. Civil War was 48 months. We've been in there now for 40 months and 13 days with the finest military that's ever been developed in basically rather a third-rate military situation. How much more do we really expect our military can do? How much more can we demand of them when they are out there doing such a proud and noble job of serving our country? How much more can we demand of them? And why isn't this demand for political accommodation? Why isn't that the front and center? so that we can start to bring our Americans home with honor.
Senator, I think there is a demand for a combination of military, political, and diplomatic activity that moves towards a solution that brings Iraq towards stability. I think over time it becomes less military and more diplomatic and more political. And I believe that this current government, that's a four-year government, has that opportunity.
General Abizaid, top U.S. commander in the Middle East earlier today. Bob Deans of Cox Newspapers, less than a minute. How'd it go today?
I think it was tough. I think it was a tough picture. I credit them with coming out there and answering the questions as best they can, but the subtext is not hard to discern. We're in a very grim situation in Iraq. It grinds away at our country. It grinds away at the political will to endure, and it grinds away in a way that we are not accustomed to coping with. I think Senator Kennedy laid it out pretty well. Gee, we're used to fighting wars where there's an end and a beginning. But where is the end point to this? Where is the beginning? General Abizaid said maybe it began in 1983. We're not even sure when it began. We have no idea when it will end.
Well, we have to end right now. But Bob Deans, national correspondent for Cox Newspapers, thanks so much for helping us look at today's Senate hearings. And you stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
The ocean is a black hole. That's what Michael Auerbach, director of Duke University Marine Laboratory, told the Senate Subcommittee on National Ocean Policy today. He concluded that a tragic historical error has occurred because more research is done about the moon than our own planet. Well, this week, a special series in the Los Angeles Times paints a grim picture of the state of the world's oceans with a look at how man-made stresses have created more than 150 dead zones in the seas. Ken Weiss was the lead reporter in the series. He spent the past year and a half traveling the world to research the story, and he joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Welcome, Ken.
Hello.
First of all, what's a dead zone?
A dead zone is actually a misnomer. It is a low oxygen, an area of low oxygen on the seafloor. It's actually teeming with life, but lower forms of life, bacteria and jellyfish.
And the problem with the dead zone would be?
That there's not enough oxygen to support any other of what we think of normally as marine life, fish, crabs, things that require oxygen to live.
And things that travel higher up the food chain and provide life.
That's correct. Right. And seafood
right.
for us to eat.
Well, the first part of your series is called The Tipping Point, and you write about the rise of slime. What is that? You write that it suggests that man-made influences are pushing the oceans back to the dawn of evolution. What is it and how so?
Well, the series looks at an accumulation of assaults on the ocean and these distress signals that we're seeing all over the globe. And it was inspired in large part by a scientist at Scripps and named Jeremy Jackson. And he says that we failed to follow the basic homeowner's rule of thumb. Be careful what you dump in the swimming pool and make sure the filter is working. And in the case of the oceans, we're using the oceans as a communal toilet for sewage and runoff and from farm fields and animal feedlots and this slurry of waste that comes out of city streets. And at the same time, we're clearing out all the salt marshes and mangrove forests that filter these nutrients and the millions of mouths of shellfish and bait fish that eat algae and bacteria and filter the seawater. And the result is an explosion of algae and bacteria. Some of it is toxic, and Jackson calls this the rise of slime.
Well, as you summarize this, humans take out everything we want from the ocean and dump everything we don't want back in.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. What is the impact of these toxins on humans and on animal life?
Well, we're starting to see sort of blowback, if you will, all over the place, and that was what we tried to do in this series is go around the world and look at where these problems are showing up. So we met fishermen in Australia who've been so plagued with rashes and boils, they have to stay off the water. And we spent time with people in Florida who thought they moved to an island paradise. This is off the west coast of Florida, but they can't go outside because red tides send toxins ashore on the sea breeze. And we went clam digging with Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest, and their subsistence diet has for centuries relied on razor clams. But now these shellfish beds are shut down, quite often because of a new toxic algae that's shown up.
I'm thinking when you mention algae, there are huge impacts, and there are also the individual ones that you're mentioning, the ones we can actually see and feel. One of the ones we can actually see is red tide. What's the impact on how we treat the oceans on red tide, and what is red tide?
Well, red tide is, again, it's a colloquial name for all these harmful algal blooms. The problem with it is that they often do not turn the ocean red, and many of them you can't see. So the ones that pop up off the New England coast, it actually doesn't turn the ocean red, but it does make the shellfish extremely toxic.
Right. You also travel to the middle of the Pacific Ocean to Midway Atoll, that's more than 1,000 miles from the nearest city, to witness the impact of plastics on the ocean. Can you remind us, first of all, how plastics end up in the middle of nowhere?
Just about all of our water, one way or another, ends up in the ocean, and it often carries all sorts of debris with it. And plastics, what makes them so durable and useful in society, also makes them very persistent as trash. So about 4/5 of the plastic in the ocean comes washing off the land or is blown by the winds into the sea. And the other 1/5 is jettisoned by ships.
Well, the LA Times has posted some videos from the trips you made while reporting the story. We want to play a little clip from Midway Atoll as wildlife biologist John Claviter cuts open the stomach of an albatross. This is to show what's contributing to the death of about 200,000 of these birds a year. Let's listen.
We oftentimes find lighters in here, little light bulbs, toothbrushes, anything that floats that basically an albatross can eat, they'll have in their stomachs. Unfortunately, you know, over time, plastics will probably become more and more prevalent in our oceans, so I hate to be pessimistic, but I'm sure the problem will become worse before it becomes better.
That's wildlife biologist John Claviter working with albatross in Midway Atoll. And by the way, that video is on the Los Angeles Times website. You can go to our website, here-now.org, to hear more of it. We're talking to journalist Ken Weiss, who reported the series in the Los Angeles Times. And Ken, we remember 20 years ago, you know, there was a movement for everyone to cut up their six-pack holders, those little plastic holders, because, you know, birds were getting those holders wrapped around their beaks and then starving to death. Obviously, the danger of plastics has progressed, as we just heard. How dangerous are plastics to wildlife?
Well, quite dangerous. The best estimates are that about 100,000 marine mammals, dolphins, seals, sea lions, sea turtles die every year getting entangled in plastic or choking on plastic, and about 1 million seabirds as well. And the clip you heard from Midway was it's quite a remarkable place, and I have to say, in all the travels, I've never been as moved as I was at that place. I've never been surrounded by so much life. There's about 2 million seabirds on that island, and so much death. About 200,000 of those albatross chicks die every year.
And hardly any mankind around, but all of its waste washing up on the shore.
It turns out, and I was surprised to learn this, that there are enormous gyres of garbage out in the Pacific. And the folks who study them, they call them garbage patches. And the one off the west coast of the United States is called the Eastern Garbage Patch, and it's roughly twice the size of Texas, a large swirling mass of plastic debris that the scientists say will basically never break down, although eventually it will sink to the seafloor.
Well, Ken Weiss, and that underscores what some of us took away from the series. It's pretty depressing. You say you were moved by seeing all of these dying birds, you know, but moved to what? Is the situation hopeless? Or is there something that can reverse any of these trends?
Well, no, of course there's hope. If we change how we're treating the oceans, you know, in the 70s we learned that we could turn lakes and rivers green by what we dump in them, and then we started to throttle back some of our practices, but now our population has grown to the point that we have to shake this notion that the oceans are too big for us to change, and that they aren't inexhaustible, and they don't have an infinite capacity to heal themselves. So we just simply have to be careful what we put in the oceans and careful what we take out.
Ken Weiss of the Los Angeles Times speaking about his series called Altered Oceans. You can read the articles and, again, see the videos and photos of his trips around the world by going to our website, here-now.org. Ken, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still to come today, a small indie road film that's become the surprise hit of the summer, Little Miss Sunshine. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. A samples, B samples. We must be talking about sports. Joining us now is Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game. Hi, Bill.
Hey.
And, of course, we're talking about Tour de France winner Floyd Landis and allegations of doping. Results, I understand, of the B sample test will be known this coming Saturday. So help us out with this alphabet here.
Well, one problem, Robin, is we shouldn't even have heard about this story because, theoretically, the A sample and B sample both have to be tested and both have to come up dirty before there is a story.
Right. And so was it the A that we heard about
yes,
initially?
Yes, we heard about the A through a leak. And the leak said that there was a bad ratio between testosterone and epitestosterone in this in Landis's sample. Now we got a second leak more recently, which says that there is synthetic testosterone, not just natural testosterone, in the same sample, the A sample. So we'll see what the B sample demonstrates.
We rush to say that leak is possibly a poor choice of words given the topic samples, but there's
yes.
no choice here. We have to. It was leaked to the press. And what does that mean, synthetic? For those of us, the uninitiated, what does it mean?
Well, everybody has testosterone in their body. Everybody produces testosterone naturally. And as it happens, the level of testosterone, which is considered normal, varies tremendously from person to person. So it's very hard to say whether just an elevated level of testosterone is the result of somebody cheating. Mm-hmm. However, if synthetic testosterone is detected in the sample, then it's easy to say that someone was cheating, whether on purpose or inadvertently. Quite often in these tests, it's turned out that these chemicals, testosterone included, have gotten into the systems of athletes through contaminated supplements that are theoretically legal, but then they're contaminated with something that's illegal.
So quick question then, if the B sample, the results are out and it confirms the original A sample, does that mean he automatically loses his title, or will some of those questions be asked?
Well, what it means for sure is that there will be a complicated appeals process, at least if precedent holds. And the other thing it probably means is that Floyd Landis will decide that it is, in fact, the right time to get his hip replaced.
And be off the scene
Absolutely.
For a little while. I remember how excited you were when he had that, 8-minute lead.
Well, it was unprecedented. The particular performance on that day was astonishing.
Yeah.
People who know a lot more about cycling than I do were calling it the single most incredible one-day performance they'd ever seen.
Yeah. Well, let's switch to a topic that is close to your heart. Not that cycling isn't, but Major League Soccer holds its All-Star game this weekend outside of Chicago. The All-Stars will play the English Premier League defending champs, Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Americans disappointed in their showing in the World Cup. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, only good things can happen, as far as I'm concerned, when a premiership team, and in fact the team that finished atop the premiership last year, plays an aggregation of Major League Soccer players, because it gives good publicity to Major League Soccer, and it is one more small step in terms of bringing professional soccer in this country into the top level of soccer on the global community.
Right, and it's just soccer, period.
Absolutely.
And we get to watch it, so
Absolutely.
That's great. That's this weekend. Well, we just want to quickly, bring up the home team, being as we are here in Boston. The Red Sox have been doing what they tend to do for a few weeks, every season. They just have these amazing closers, walk-off home runs, and they did it again last night. Two out, bases loaded. Mark Loretta hit a double in the bottom of the ninth with a 6-5 win over Cleveland. Monday, there was another one. This was a big poppy, David Ortiz.
Some guy named Ortiz
Who's been sort of hitting them out, whenever it's needed. But how do they look overall? Those were exciting moments, but how do they look overall?
Very exciting moments, although considerable help from Fausto Carmona, the Cleveland reliever, who did his Calvin Schiraldi act and blew up on the pitching mound, hit two guys, walked a guy, and then gave up a double in the ninth inning. But the thing that nobody's talking about here in Boston, because optimism reigns supreme, is that while the Red Sox have been performing as you have suggested, the Yankees have quietly slipped into first place by 2 percentage points.
Oh, right.
So despite all the injuries, the disappointments, all kinds of problems in New York, it's the Yankees that the Red Sox are currently looking up at right now.
All right, then. Thank you for reminding us of that. Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game. Be sure to watch all weekend for, the best in sports and stuff that has sometimes nothing to do with sports. But we
Absolutely
love that you talk
true.
About it. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
We'll be right back.
families are a dime a dozen. There's plenty of raw material, after all. But a road movie that squeezes a wacky family of oddballs into a sputtering VW bus and then climaxes at a beauty pageant for little girls, well, now that's something new.
Everybody push! All right. Here we go. Push! Push! Okay. Okay.
I just want everyone here to know that I am the preeminent Drew Scholar in the United States.
5 years in the making, Little Miss Sunshine won standing ovations at the Sundance Film Festival, where it also fueled a bidding war for distribution rights. Now the film is traveling to theaters across the U.S., and Here Now's Andrea Shea explains why Little Miss Sunshine is a family affair in more ways than one.
Before making Little Miss Sunshine, co-directors Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton looked back at episodes of the 1973 PBS series An American Family.
It was the first, you know, I hate to even use the term reality program, where they followed a family for a whole year, and then they made 13 episodes or something. And we saw it when we were kids, and we went back to the UCLA archives and watched this documentation of An American Family, and it was really influential.
Because it was a brutally honest portrayal of family life, sort of an anti-Brady Bunch. Dayton thinks Little Miss Sunshine is like that, too, despite being fictional and a comedy. But inevitably, Dayton says all family road movies are held up against the benchmark of the subgenre.
Definitely National Lampoon Vacation has come up a lot, and hopefully people can see how different two films with similar plot lines can be.
The Chevy Chase vehicle Vacation and Little Miss Sunshine have a few things in common, including a beat-up car, desert travel, a few tense arguments, and a chirpy grandparent in the back seat. But the grandpa in Little Miss Sunshine has one up on Grandma Griswold. He snorts heroin and is addicted to porn. The father in Little Miss Sunshine peddles a 9-step program for success without much success of his own. His bleak teenage son takes a vow of silence in honor of Nietzsche. Olive, the cherubic 7-year-old daughter, dreams of being a beauty queen. There's the Proust scholar uncle who attempts suicide after being dumped by his gay lover, and the mom, ever stable, honest, and supportive.
Why did you want to kill yourself?
No, don't answer the question, Frank.
Richard.
Don't answer it.
Richard.
He's not going to answer the question, Frank.
I wanted
Richard.
To kill myself.
Don't listen to him.
Richard.
Because I was
He's
very
He's
unhappy.
A sick man. He's a sick in his head man.
Richard.
I'm sorry. I don't think it's an appropriate conversation for a 7-year-old.
Well, she's going to find out anyway.
Okay.
Olive soon finds out she's been accepted to compete in the Little Miss Sunshine beauty pageant. Then the whole family reluctantly crams into their VW bus to get Olive to the contest on time. And while the plot's a little zany, directors Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris say there's nothing unusual about the Hoovers.
I don't really know what a dysfunctional family is other than just a regular family. I think all families have moments of dysfunction and moments where things come together.
I think we related to them, you know, just how tough it is to get along sometimes because families are an oddball collection of characters, you know, that otherwise wouldn't probably be spending time except for the fact that they're blood related.
Faris and Dayton speak from experience. While they aren't blood related, they are married. With 3 children between them, they admit Little Miss Sunshine hits them where they live. Family life, they say, is a matter of forced acceptance.
Because you can be at your worst with your family, that's part of what's great about family, is there aren't that many places where you can sort of be at your lowest and not be kicked out, you know?
Yeah. It's a permanent membership.
Yeah.
The members of the Hoover family are put through the emotional ringer in Little Miss Sunshine. Like a good horror film, the story swings from one extreme to another.
I think life is a roller coaster ride. If you have a family, I think having children particularly, you know, you realize how quickly the tone of the moment can change from a complete drama to absurd comedy.
There's no genre for that. It's just that there's some kind of truth in it.
Actress Toni Collette is the patient mom in Little Miss Sunshine. In this scene, she plays the peacekeeper between her husband and brother.
I feel sorry for you.
You do? Good.
Yeah, I do. Because sarcasm is the refuge of losers.
It is? Really?
Yep. So
Sarcasm is losers trying to bring winners down to their level, and that's step four in the program.
Wow, Richard, you really opened my eyes to what a loser I am. How much do I owe you for those pearls of
wisdom? Oh, that one's on the house, buddy.
It is?
Yeah, it's okay, on the house.
Guys,
that's on the house.
Hey, wow. Guys,
that was
great.
For free.
No charge.
Stop You're it. Not
no
going to
charge.
Stop it.
Colette says in family, everyone assumes a position.
Everyone plays a certain role. I think most families do that. And perhaps the story here is that people step outside their roles and each member sees each other for who they really are. And I think it's ultimately very freeing for all of them.
Directors Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris stepped outside their usual roles by making Little Miss Sunshine. For more than 20 years, the couple has directed award-winning music videos and documentaries for REM, Jane's Addiction, Beck, and others. While this is their feature film debut, Dayton says directing an ensemble of seasoned actors, including Colette, Greg Kinnear, Steve Carell, and Alan Arkin, is a lot like working with a long-standing band, such as the Red Hot Chili Peppers, led by singer Anthony Kiedis.
You never have to tell Anthony Kiedis how to move. You talk about the setting and then you let him do what he does. And Alan Arkin is a master. You don't need to ever tell him how to be funny.
Or sincere. Here's Arkin's character with his granddaughter.
Grandpa?
Yeah?
Am I pretty?
Olive, you are the most beautiful girl in the whole world.
Yeah, you're just saying that.
No, I'm not. I'm madly in love with you. And it's not because of your brains or your personality. It's because you're beautiful, inside and out.
And even though a children's beauty pageant drives the action in Little Miss Sunshine, Faris says that's not what it's about.
The film really is about the contests that we put ourselves in throughout life, not just this one climactic moment.
Getting Little Miss Sunshine made was a contest in its own right. It took 5 years to cobble together the financing, but in the end, the husband and wife say working together on the film was far easier than running their own family.
The crews always listen to us the first time. You don't have to ask twice, but our kids...
A set is like a super functional family. You know, like everybody listens, they do what they're supposed to be doing, they work really hard, you know. I think, you know, raising a family prepared us for making this movie, but it didn't necessarily make it any easier to make the movie.
And, like watching a grown kid head off to college, Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton say it isn't easy to let their film, Little Miss Sunshine, go.
I fell in love again.
That was Here and Now's Andrea Shea on Little Miss Sunshine. The film opens in theaters across the country today.
All things know, we sold our clothes to the state. I don't mind, I made a lot of mistakes in my mind.
Listen to the music of Sufjan Stevens from the film Little Miss Sunshine. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hathi, and Virginia Prescott. Vince Fairchild is our engineer, our web producer, Ken George. Our interns are Jamie Ulrich, Lauren Moran, Jessica Wall, and Jamie Lorber. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
I don't mind. I don't mind, I was in love with a place in my mind, I made a lot of mistakes in my mind.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here.